Jim is a great friend of Jesus Christ, a great disciple of Jesus Christ, and a great Catholic man. He's shown that not only in his work and in his ministry, but also as a husband and a father. Jim taught high school theology for quite a long time. We were on the faculty there together for many, many, many years. Jim is now on the pastoral staff of St. Helens in Newberry. He is maybe the most sought-after speaker in the diocese. He's given talk after talk throughout the diocese. And he's also an author, and he's shy about that a little bit. So I'm going to plug the three books that he has on the table over there, and this will make his wife happy too. They're only $5 a piece. It's a trilogy, and it's meant to make the faith very, very accessible, very readable. It's good, easy reading without being simplistic and without distorting the faith. But it's you know, our faith is very, very profound, right? But you can't always read the real profound stuff. You just can't. You need a break from the profound stuff. And this is very, very readable. So with that, please welcome Jim Hogan.
Thank you for those kind words. Now, please lower your expectations. That would be good. Being a speaker at something like this is like being a body at an Irish wake. I'm necessary for the thing to happen, but no one really wants to hear me speak. But I thought you've been probably listening an incredible amount today, correct? Okay, so let's try this. If you don't want to do this, this is totally okay. But let's try it. Let's try this to be interactive. What are your biggest issues, concerns, raising young men today to be saints? Because if you're here to turn boys into men, I need to leave, go someplace else. You're here, your job is to turn boys into saints. I got one goal. Hey, there you go, Mike. I got one goal, and that is to get my little children somehow into the kingdom of God. That's all I want. I don't care what size car they have or fancy house. I just want heaven. I don't want my kids to be happy. I want them to be eternally happy, right? And I think so. If that's the focus, and we could talk about that if you will, but I just thought first, let me talk about what you'd like me to talk about. What are your bigger challenges out there raising guys to be good saints?
Number one concern for me is just teaching my young men how to be able to stand firm in the face of the culture that they're going to have to live in and eventually raise children of their own.
Amen. Yeah. I would say it may be the number. If you're convicted in your faith, I don't know, maybe not all of you are. Most of you, I'm sure, are, but maybe not. That would be the first thing, because I think you have to be the kind of person you want your kid to become. So the first thing is to get your spiritual ship together. I didn't say the other, I said ship, right? To get your spiritual ship together. Right? That's the first thing. And then be willing to spend quantity as well as quality time with your kid. I think it's a factor of both. I don't know about you, but I would spend sometime 3 hours in a car with my son going to a soccer game. And he would be totally shut off on that little damn magic box or whatever it is, you know. And here's this chance for me to do this quality time, and he just doesn't want it, you know. And then, right before bed or something, he'll start talking about his life. And I'm like, really? Now? There's this thing on Netflix that I really want to see. You know, the most inconvenient time to actually talk about God and life. Yeah, and that's what they pick. So I think sometimes the quality moments comes out of the quantity moments. So that's the first thing. Given that that's true, then Jeff, your question is the question. How do you do that in this culture? I don't know. Every day. It's day by day. You can't think of this culture as a Christian culture anymore. It's not. It's decidedly anti-Christian. When they're going to do some commercial reference to drag queens tomorrow at the Super Bowl, could you have imagined that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that they would ever try to advocate that? You can't get a commercial that's pro-traditional marriage at the Super Bowl. You can't get a pro-life. Remember Tim Tebow tried to do that a few years back? And it wasn't even in-your-face pro-life. It was just, thanks, Mom, for adopting me. That was all it was. And that was a big controversy. And yet now, you can get a pro-drag queen message. Millions of people will see that. So even if everything I say today is fabulously successful with you, I'm still spitting into a tidal wave. And so are you. But I think truth has a power all of its own. I think love has a power all of its own. And even if you don't think you're unbelievably influential in the life of your child, you are. You are. It is amazing how, I don't know, you probably had this experience yourself. It was amazing how sort of irrelevant my father was when I was 18 and how unbelievably relevant he became when I was about 23. There's a ton, you're planting seeds. All you're doing now as a dad is you're a farmer. You're throwing seeds. And some of it's going to take root. Some of it's not. And it's ultimately up to him. In fact, is Marty still? No, Marty left us. He's gone to do a talk. I remember Marty's kids were a little bit older than my kids. And I remember saying to him and his wife, Mary Jin, once, I said, we're going to parent kind of like you did. Because I thought he did a really good job with his kids. And Marty said, oh, thanks, Hoags. That's really nice. But you know what? There's that damn free will. And that's the thing. Every one of us could do an unbelievably wonderful job in raising our children, but there's that damn free will. They can ultimately make choices for themselves, and it's not your job ultimately to save them. You've got one job and one job only, and that is to create an environment in your family that is conducive to them saying yes to Christ. That's it. Doesn't necessarily mean they're gonna, because there's that damn free will, right? They're ultimately free to decide their own salvation. And you could do everything right, and they might choose wrong. You might do a lot of stuff wrong, and they could choose right. And that's what scares, I think, parents the most, is that free will down the road. I just think we have to have a very critical, hostile approach to the culture and be able to analyze where they're coming from. And maybe, here's a little dose of hope, because I'm sure, Jeff, I depressed the heck out of you. Maybe if we give them enough rope, maybe they'll hang themselves. Maybe as they get more and more ludicrous and unbelievably stupid, maybe that will turn people back to reconsidering Jesus. Could you imagine getting in trouble, even 10 years ago, for saying, there is such a thing as men and women, and there are only men and women. That's not what you're going to hear at John Carroll University. You're not going to hear that anymore. You're going to hear that there are 100 different genders. And I'm like, no, there's two. There's 98 gender dysphorias, but there's only male and female. At work, Bill was saying at work as well, really? That's being integrated into some workplaces that you have to acknowledge that there are 56 different genders. Now, I raised my kids, in the 90s, so all there was male, female, and Michael Jackson. Those were the only three possible. No, I'm just kidding. There was male and female. That was it. And again, that wasn't anything, even a question that could get you in trouble. It was just, if I were to stand up in front of a students at Ignatius and said, there's only male and female, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they would have gone, yeah, what, that's like saying there's air outside. Yeah, not debating it. And yet now that's being debated today as if that's an object of debate. That would be, look for three elements in the culture. It's a hydra. Remember, the hydra has got the three heads on the monstrous dragon. The three heads are secularism, materialism, and relativism. And we're becoming so relativistic, not only now about morality, which is really the first area of defense, we're also even about reality now. Now we're even saying you can say something that's completely, utterly anti-science. They're simply male and female. There are two genders. It's just common sense. Now, by the way, you could change your appearance of your gender. Sure, of course, you could change that. You could be on, and there are all sorts of people that are free in America to believe anything they want to believe. Tom Cruise thinks he's a reincarnated alien. I'm not joking. That's Scientology. He really believes that he is a reincarnated alien from another planet. Right? And in a way, fine, as long as you're not forcing that on my family. But the difference, I think, the problem with the transgendered movement right now is not only do they wish to believe that, they're going to force you to believe that. And then that is in violation of your Catholic faith. And the thing that got saints in trouble in the early church was not just that they proclaimed that Jesus was God. In fact, that was just a religion in the Roman mind. It was when, because they believed that Jesus was God, they refused to worship the Roman gods, and therefore the Roman emperors. And that's when, you know, Ignatius of Antioch got torn apart by lions. That's when Justin the Martyr got murdered. That's when Paul gets beheaded, is because the Christians came against government and said, no, wait a minute, there's no God but God. So government's great, but government has to be subordinate to the will of God. And if that's still true with you, that means there's always going to be a tension between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man. And it's just going to come constantly in conflict. The Little Sisters of the Poor are still being persecuted. I know they won the case, you know, 2 years ago. You know, they're still at trial in various states. They're just contesting them anyway, even though the Supreme Court already settled the issue that they're allowed religious freedom. Utterly obsessed with forcing poor Claire's nuns to sell condoms to their employees. Again, could you ever have imagined that 10, 15, 20 years ago in this country? So there's just, it's turning more towards open warfare towards Christianity. Okay, maybe that'll help. Maybe that assault will help define the terms. Because I think even on a basic level, most people know that it doesn't really make sense to say other than just male and female. Again, you can't change your sex. You can change the appearance of your sex, but you can't change your sex. You're either a male or a female. Every single cell in my body is mapped male. I can't change that. That's just science. That's just reality. Isn't that funny how we're anti-science? But being anti-science has its basis, right, in Christianity as well, because think about it. If you are a rock-solid atheist in front of me right now, it would not take a believer to believe that an unborn child is a unique, genetically distinct human life inside the womb. That's not religion. That's not Jesus. That's just science. It's an absolute fact that the fetus is a distinct human life inside the womb. Yet, I'm sure you've heard, and you'll hear for the rest of your natural life, my body, my choice. No, that's actually scientifically not accurate. It's two bodies, two choices. It's a body inside a body. It's the rights of two bodies as opposed to the rights of one. That's just the scientific fact, the existence of the bodies. But we started to lose that kind of reality back in 73. So in a way, it doesn't surprise me that we'd continue to go and deny science whenever a certain belief gets in the way. People will believe what they believe even when scientific data is in front of them that utterly contradicts it. And I'm not talking about scientific consensus. Scientific consensus is, for example, what we often hear with the global warming debate. You know, what's the scientific consensus? We're not dealing with scientific consensus with abortion. We're dealing with scientific facts. The fetus is, in fact, a unique, genetically distinct human being, separate from that of mom and dad, a body inside a body. I remember being at a pro-life thing, and there were, you know, people debating on the other side outdoors, and the one lady said, "It's the fetus is a part of my body." So I came out to her and I said, if that were really true, if the fetus were a part of your body, like a tonsils or your spleen, and your fetus happens to be male, then you, lady, have a penis. And her eyes got very big, and she said, that's ridiculous. And I said, yes, yes, it is ridiculous because the fetus is not a part of your body. It's a body inside a body. It's a body attached to a body. But see, we're becoming anti-science as well. Maybe, maybe, little by little, that will bring people back to some common sense truth along the way. It shouldn't be hard to demonstrate to your sons that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. And oh, and second point, men are different than women, thank God, right? That would be the other assumption, which I could talk about too, but I'm talking too much. Other thoughts within that or any other concerns you might have? I want to, what concerns you? Wait, can you let me get you a microphone? This is your moment, you know, to have a mic all day.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's like schools around here that are kind of Catholic, and they have sports programs. And if you support them, you're really supporting the culture that's, you know, they're just pretty much the same as the public school.
Kind of ironic that you would give me that question if you know my background. God has a sense of humor. Well, I remember when Bishop Lennon took over, he came to St. Ignatius, where I happened to be teaching at the time, and met with the theology department, and we talked about issues and all that, and we basically told him what we were teaching, and he said a little, you know, whatever. And then he said, any comments? Well, me, you know, Irish mouth. And I just said, well, and he was brand new. So I said, well, Bishop, one thought is that I think you have in our diocese many Catholic schools that are afraid to be Catholic. And he was very good about it. He said, yeah, I think you're right. In fact, and then he went into a story of going to a Catholic college and getting really, you know, anti-approach. I kept saying, then you're the bishop. I didn't do that, you know. I think that's your job. You have, you know, the power. I couldn't say that. But he agreed with me as well. And I do think, again, it's part of the culture that sometimes cultural elements factor in to why people get jobs. And I don't think that a lot of people went into teaching at a Catholic school necessarily because they really believed in the doctrines of the faith. I think they wanted to be teachers, and it's a good place to be a teacher. It's usually good, you know, good behavior, and it's a nice culture to be a teacher in. So we never necessarily demanded of the teachers that they assent to Catholic teaching or even necessarily believed it. So as a consequence, little by little, as the culture gets stronger and stronger, they got more and more with the culture and less with Catholic teaching. So it's become an issue, I think, for a lot of them as to whether or not Catholic schools are really able to be or really even willing to necessarily be Catholic. They'll be Catholic on those issues where the culture is already on their side. You probably couldn't tell me a Catholic school that said racism is okay because the culture says racism is bad. Thank God, they should. It's a Catholic doctrinal teaching. It's infallible teaching. You cannot be a racist and be a Catholic. That's good. The only area where it gets confused is when you get into the realm of sexual teaching. Because the minute you throw sex into the equation, nobody can think morally straight anymore. It's just true, right? Think, and by the way, we mentioned abortion earlier. That's really also why that issue is cloudy. Even though you'd be right if you technically said, no, wait a minute, abortion has nothing to do with sex, it's life or death. You're either killing the baby or you're not killing the baby. Let's discuss. The problem is, let's be honest, it's used as backup birth control. So for a lot of people, they put it into the realm of the sex issue, and therefore they can't think straight about it. If the Catholic Church would just shut up on sexual matters, people would love us. Think about all the issues that really bring great controversy. Not all of them, but many of them. Divorce, contraception, right? Pornography, homosexuality, premarital sex, living together, abortion. If the Catholic Church would just stop talking about those issues, the culture would love them. And by the way, we'd be utterly irrelevant. And we would really die out. Because if the Catholic Church becomes the culture, why the heck do you got to go to Mass? Most guys don't like going to Mass. They don't like sitting around for an hour. Certainly your sons don't. And I'm assuming some of your sons don't like to go to Mass. Because for them it's kind of boring. So if the culture becomes equal to Mass, what's the point of going to Mass? The purpose of the culture is not... The Catholic Church can't be moved by the culture. The purpose of the church is to move the culture. That's what it always did. That's what it always will do. It's always going to be something that's going to be a challenge to the culture of its time. Jesus was a challenge to his culture of time. We're always going to be a challenge to the culture, given whatever time that we're in. The battle that we're in now is the same battle. The culture hasn't changed at all. Human nature is the same as it always has been. Therefore, it's just the story of Jesus retold and retold and retold, and it's being retold in your lifetime right now. And the question is, will you follow Jesus or will you not follow Jesus? It's the same question. Yes, let me get you your microphone so people can hear you. I feel like Phil Donahue, if you know that reference.
Thanks, Jim. So many years of experience teaching in a Catholic boys' high school. How would you discuss pornography with your high school men, young boys? And how would you steer them in the right direction?
Just tell them the facts. It's great when you have all boys, because you can really deal with it. Women like to complain, and rightfully so, that they have it harder than we do. Yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, you think about all the different complexities of sufferings that women ultimately endure. There's one that we have. I have to defend our man folk here. There is one minor one that we have as well. And it's so great to tell them the difference between men and women. And that is, well, this is obvious to you, but something we really need to teach to the boys and then ultimately teach to the girls. And that is that for a man, arousal is linked to the visual. It's not necessarily so for a woman. It's often tactile. For a woman, often context matters for them to want to engage in relations. Guys could do it anywhere. If they're visually aroused, it doesn't matter. No guy ever looked at a Playboy or a Sports Illustrated swimsuit model and went, gee, I wonder what her GPA was. No, it's very easy for us to be visually aroused. If you don't believe me, I'll give you anecdotal evidence. Show me a place in the mall called Victor's Secret. Doesn't exist. Victoria, yeah, that exists, because how a woman looks is extremely important to a man. By virtue of us being visually aroused, as well as tactily, by touch aroused, by being visually aroused, Hollywood knows that. So Hollywood is constantly going to bombard us with images that we're really, really, really going to like, and yet it's also going to keep us ultimately away from our commitment to my wife. If I see like an attractive woman in a movie that I would consider to be borderline exploitive, my reaction to my wife would be to say, like, what an utter objectifying of women. Keep it on. I'm a guy. I like that. So it's not as easy. See, that's what's different about the sexual realm than it is, I don't know, meanness. You know? I used to tell students that, and I still tell them at St. Helens as well. So, like, if you're a high school boy and you're going to a movie because you like to see, like, heads, like these horror movies, you know, like where the heads are chopped off and blood is spurting everywhere. My reaction to that is, I don't understand that. I have no interest in that at all. That just makes no sense to me. But if you're going to a movie because you think this one actress is really, really hot, I get that. I'm not saying you should do that or give in to that impulse, but I understand that impulse because that's the nature of being male. Most kids then look at, when you tie that visual arousal that they're being already by the culture programmed to look at women objectively, it's very easy for them to shift into pornography. If I wanted to see a hard R-rated movie growing up, us Camps Corners, west side of Cleveland, I would have had to go to the old Riverside movie theater. It doesn't exist anymore. All right, put on a trench coat and hope to God that no one who knew my family saw me go into that movie theater. Because back then we had this concept called neighborhoods. I'm sure some of you have never heard of them, you younger people here, where actually all the different neighbors would narc on the kids. They would actually tell on you, and your parents were okay with it. These days, if you say anything negative about any child, the parents will attack you. Parents said constant negative things about me. I usually deserved it, you know, and my parents went, oh, thank you. Yes, we will, you know, now we will pound Jimmy, you know, and that's kind of how it worked. So it wasn't that I didn't have the inclination towards the soft pornography in that case. It's that there was a system in place in the culture, going back to culture, there was a system in place that prevented me from acting on it. It's gone. It's gone. It's on their box. It's three clicks of a mouse. It's there. And you probably don't know what's on their cell phones. I don't know what's on my kids' cell phones. I mean, I look every now and then. I'll do that, you know, just to freak them out. But it's hard. It's hard to know because they could have images stored in ways that you don't know. Michael, just jump in.
There's tools and filters you can put on your kids' phones, but I have a feeling that the kids are one step ahead of us. So are you better off just letting them have a free will and just tell them what your expectations are, or do you go and buy all the latest security software and spy on them and, you know, try to catch them? I struggle with that.
How? I guess my own personal thought is kind of Ronald Reagan with the Russians. Trust but verify. Trust but verify. I would trust them, and trust is earned. So as they show themselves to be capable of using it responsibly, to that extent, I think you let go and give them the opportunity to live their lives. If you were in the verifying side, see a problem, I think that's when you try to crack down a little bit more. Again, I have four daughters, one son. I've checked their phones. I've never seen a problem with the girls. Again, it's more of a guy issue when it's at least talking about pornography or things like that. But it's coming in so many different forms. They can get messages from people that they think are coming from Asia to send, like, pretending to be a girl when they're not girls and want pictures of your son naked. It's happening. It's happening around you. You know, there are boys out there that prior to dating request naked pictures of your daughters or they won't go out on the date. It's called sexting. Oh my God, that's so foreign to the way I was raised. But that's the culture that you're living in. So I would say trust but verify. I have no problem with putting good ways of limiting access because that's the culture. They have access to access in a way that we would have never dreamed possible. But then again, education being the progressive assignment of responsibility. So given that your son or daughter is able to use it responsibly, yeah, allow them that freedom, and you would check less, and you wouldn't have to do as much verification. Someone had a thought over here. Yes? Steven.
Just kind of along those lines. Yeah. I have two boys, a 22-year-old and a 20-year-old. The 20-year-old is actually a second-year seminarian here, and I'm here today with my stepson, who is now 15. And I can tell you I learned a lot from the older two that I'm now applying to my stepsons. And one of those things is, and this is totally just from my perspective of the sexuality talk that I have with Nicholas, is from the perspective of, dude, I get it. I'm a guy just like you. I've done what you've done. I've thought the things you think. Because I think just from my perspective of, I think they really get embarrassed. I know that they get embarrassed about having the thoughts that they have, you know, the nocturnal emissions, all that kind of stuff of, holy crap, what's going on with my body? I've had those frank conversations with them to the point where of saying, look, it happens to every single person. If your buddies at school act like it doesn't happen to them, they're freaking liars because it happens to every man. Then tack that on to what I try to do, and more so even with my wife, and currently at St. Francis Xavier in Medina, they're going through a process now called human dignity and dignity of the body, which I think is awesome. because then I kind of couple that on to what my son has taught me from the seminary of their teaching them of, now look at it from the perspective, every man has that sin or the potential for that sin, but God expects more of you. And kind of that perspective of them, of you're going to fall short, things are going to happen, but always strive to protect your body because it's something that God gave us. And again, if I just keep saying it and doing it to the point where the one who's with me today, he kind of clicked one day and finally came to me and is able to have frank conversations of, hey, that happened again. That's fine, buddy. It happened to me when I was your age too. And I think if it's that, if you just at least let him know, we were that age once too. I went through what you were going through. That's at least a little opening, because I used to be, on the other end of it, preach, 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 pound, pound, pound. You know, what are you doing? You can't do that. And that got me nowhere.
Thank you. Just too fast. Beautiful, Steve. How wonderful that we give them the idea that we're all in this together. By the way, I'm still waiting for the sex talk from my dad. Like nothing. I'm operating under the assumption that my father had, you know, 5 immaculate conceptions. I'm sorry, you can't convince me otherwise. I know that's irrational. Very different than what you're doing then with your son, which is to try to, say we're going to fall in this struggle, and we're all in it ultimately together if we're guys. These are hard things to bring up because sometimes they're at an age where they really just don't want to hear that from you. And you probably don't want to give it, you don't want to talk about it to them. I don't blame you, you know. That's why it's so great to have other people say it with you, not for you, but with you. Get other, I think theology of the body is one of the great, great weapons the Catholic Church has. It, ironic, right, that John Paul the Great wrote a book in 1960, right, published in America in 1960, Love and Responsibility, which was the beginnings of theology of the body. The exact same year, the pill was made legal in the United States. Had people bought that book instead of the pill, I think we'd be a happier culture than we are today. But you're absolutely right. If we can get them to believe that this is, we're all in this together, and that what you're experiencing is pretty much what we experience, and we all struggle in this area, I think that will go a long way. And then if you can, supplement it any way you can with other speakers that can maybe say it for you, you know, or supplement what you're saying. Who was asking me earlier just about Catholic schools? It's Catholic schools, right? You were talking about Catholic schools. That's ideally what it should be. So what if the theology teacher taught them Catholic truth, and then they go to science class and get Catholic truth, and then go to gym and get Catholic truth, and go to health? Do you know what a world that would make? Do you know how wonderful that would be? Do you know how much easier it would be for kids if they were getting hit from different sides? It was wonderful when I was, you know, when my era of being with Marty at St. Ignatius, I could only hit certain kids just by virtue of my personality, because I understand I can't be all things to all people. But I knew when he left Mike, I was going to get Marty. And then he was going to get Jimmy Skirl. Then he was going to get Tom Healy. Then he was going to get Jim Brennan. Then he was going to get Drew Valinsky. And he was going to get hit this different guys with their different charisms, with their different abilities, all the same message. You know what happens when that happens? Faith happens. I can't tell you how many amazing, really cool religious kids came out of that experience. Because it wasn't just you alone in a sea by yourself. The church was supporting the family. And that's the function of the Catholic Church, is to support the first church, which is the family. That's, read the catechism. The first domestic church is the family. Their job is to be backing you up, not to be at odds with you. Their job is to be back supporting you in teaching the Catholic faith to that child.
Back to the John Paul II comment.
Yes.
You know, I think that the secret nugget within the theology of the body and within his personalism, his teachings, is that, you know, we're not going to change men by saying, don't think about these things. As soon as I tell you pink elephant, you're going to think pink elephant. Right. But if you teach them how to convert a beautiful sight, like a beautiful woman, into this is a creation by God that we can love, made to be loved only, not something to be used, not a thing to be used, you suddenly have a vision that is, it's the same thing in your eyes, but it's completely different because it's redeemed. And if we don't teach our sons how to redeem what's before them, regardless, it's going to come. You know, that woman walking down the street is going to be either abused in your mind or elevated to a great creation of God that is not meant to be used, but instead made to be loved. And if we teach ourselves and our kids, and we got to start with ourselves, we have to start when something comes on the TV or wherever, we need to be aware that our internal reaction is visible to everybody around. If we're using them for our own pleasure, power, possession in our own mind, then that's translated. So we start with ourselves and teach ourselves how to love the woman or the vision before us, and then we're on our way, and that's how our sons can learn.
Are some of you guys teaching theology? You're really good at it. That was really good. Wow, that's fantastic. I just, for all of these comments, I can only wholly agree with what you're saying. I think there is, in the act of beholding a really beautiful girl, even if she's not my wife, just I see a really beautiful girl, the first element of that is really something religious. There's a moment almost of like of an ecstatic experience because for you've had this, haven't you? When you see a really beautiful girl, you just sort of go, for a minute, for a millisecond, you're not thinking of yourself at all. You're just lost in the beauty of that girl. And remember, the beauty isn't coming from her. It's going through her. The beauty's source is God. She's being the instrument of that beauty in that moment. So there is something unbelievably religious about that first experience. The problem, of course, with the culture particularly and with human sin is that it's so easy to go to the next step, which is the exact opposite, which is, oh, yeah, I want that. I got to have it. I got to own it for myself and make an object out of it. When, I mean, in the garden, use that as your metaphor. In the garden, Adam would have 100% focused his sexual attraction on Eve. And he would have seen Eve as Eve. There is some place where you could get that back. It's called the honeymoon, ideally. And beyond that, where you can see your wife's beauty. You can still be aroused by your wife's beauty, but you see more than just that. You see the person. And that's the trick, to see the beauty of the person, but not lose sight of the person along the way. And lust is that preconditions you to see just the object in front of you rather than the individual behind it. It's almost like a flight simulator. You get onto a flight simulator and you train how to actually fly. Pornography is almost a sex simulator. It teaches a lust simulator. It's going to teach you how to use that as lust. A student once asked me, what's the hardest thing about being married? And I kind of alluding to what you said, I said, I had to think about it a while. I actually didn't have an answer for like 20 minutes. And I came back to what I said, I think the hardest thing for me getting married was to stop thinking about women the way I had preconditioned myself to think about women for the last 27 years. Because that's the great mistake that your high school students are going to do. In their, they're going to go, look, Dad, you're for marriage. And you're for family. And that's cool. Really, it is. I'm for it. I think it's great. But, there's the big qualifier, right? But, I'm not there yet. You know, I plan on getting married at 27, 28 years old. I'm 16 now. I'm going to get married when I'm 28. So it's time for me to sow my wild oats. Yes, I'll be for marriage then. I will. I think marriage is great. That's what they're thinking in their heads. But until then, I can buy into pornography. I can buy into the masturbatory fantasy. The problem with that is what they don't realize is they're conditioning their brain. When they get to the point of marriage, they're going to make the mistake that marriage changes a person. It doesn't. You're the same person the day after you got married as the day, you know, before you got married. What's changed is the dynamic of the relationship. The two have become one, but you're the same you. So all of the years of looking at women in that way has been ingrained in you for, let's say, 20 years or 10 years, and you're bringing that to the marriage. You've trained your mind to expect different women, and every one of those women in the masturbatory fantasy always does exactly what you tell them to do, and you're, of course, perfect in everything you do, and now you're bringing that down to reality. And as beautiful as your wife may be, she can't possibly change into 50 different women. But that's what you've conditioned your brain to expect. That's what masturbation and pornography does. And all pornography does is trying to ingrain masturbation into who you are. That's what it does. The purpose of Playboy magazine is to elicit arousal. Arousal is to elicit masturbation. Let's start saying the truth about what pornography is really all about. It's lighter fluid on lust. That's what it is. So this mentality that you've now ingrained in yourself, you're bringing to bear for this one woman who might think that the way she approaches sex is the same way you do. Because no one ever told them that men and women approach sex completely differently. And that puts a great strain on a lot of marriages. But even worse than that, there's a great line in the movie Beckett when Henry II says, "A good occupational army does not crush, it corrupts." What if you were the devil? What if you were the worst evil human being on the world and you wanted to come up with a system that was going to draw kids away from God and the faith? Well, you could do an open assault on atheism, but then at least you've got them in the reason category. You can out-reason them, reason them there, or you can do the historical evidence on Jesus and stuff like that. I do some of those little blurbs in the Captain Catholic series about why we can believe that Jesus is Lord or why God exists. We could get them on the front of reason. But wouldn't it be much more of a genius move if little by little I could take their sexuality, which is a core part of our existence, and then little by little, little by little, little by little, move it away from what the Catholic Church is saying. And then after a while, all right, at age 15, 16, maybe 21, especially at colleges, because college, let's be honest, is a four-year extension of high school. It's 4 years away from the parents where you can do whatever you can do. And very few of those colleges, we were just talking about this, very few of those colleges will really affirm the Catholic teaching in any way, shape, or form. If you can get little by little, draw them away, after a while, that kid's going to notice the gap. He's going to notice the gap between his core identity, his sexual behavior and sexual thought, and what the Catholic Church is saying. And he's only going to notice the gap. He's not going to notice the undertow that drew him out there. And he's going to draw him away from the Catholic faith. And that's genius. That's brilliant. Or a better word for it, it's diabolical. And as you know, the word diabolical, diabolos, the devil. It's demonic. So we've created a system that in the minds of your sons are going to convince them that their sexuality is none of God's business. Read Genesis. That's why I love the old story of Abraham. I never really thought of this interpretation before, you know. But what's the thing that Abraham, in order to show faith, what's he do? What's his sign of the covenant? Circumcision. He cuts his penis. I love it. He's got to give his penis to God. He's got to give his sexual choices to God. And that's always the hardest thing for a guy to give to God. I can give you this, I'll give you this, I'll give you my work life, I'll give you my family life, but not my sexual identity, not that. No, I'm going to keep that to myself. But as that goes away from the Catholic faith, eventually it breaks the faith along the way. Our kids have been sold a bill of goods. Sex doesn't matter. At record amounts now, they're not getting married anymore. They're shacking up. And what's that really saying? That's saying, that's your son saying to that girl, "I love you." Today, I'm not going to commit to tomorrow. I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. That's none of you did that when you got married. You said, "I love you. I love you." That means forever. That's enduring. Read Corinthians 13. Love is enduring. Love never fails. We've lost the concept of love. It's an insult to any woman to say, "I will love you temporarily," instead of, "I'll give my whole being, my whole life over to you." So instead of that, we've taught them to marginalize that and move that further and further and further away from the faith. That's why we've got to get back to the controversial issues. We have to wrestle with traditional marriage, pro-life issue. I know these are hard things to deal with. I know. If you've got a party at your house and you want people to leave, bring up homosexuality or abortion. In 15 minutes, they'll all be gone. Nobody wants to talk about these things because they're, and teachers don't either. Because if they talk about him, they're going to get calls from parents, and teachers just want to be left alone. Right, Andrew? You don't want that kind of stuff. You don't want calls from angry parents at Benedictine. You know, you want to just be able to go home because you're exhausted. So they just leave the controversial stuff behind, but the culture doesn't. They're 100% passionately committed to their anti-Catholic point of view, and little by little, they're taking control of the lives of our kids, which is, we can't have that. So all we got to do that, am I depressing you? I hope I'm not. We need to analyze the culture and see it for what it ultimately is doing. One last moment of depression before we get into the good news, right? One last moment. If you do that, if you teach kids, if you brainwash them to believe that sex doesn't have any meaning apart from what you give it, the problem with that's going to be is they're eventually going to try that out in real life. And they're going to actually have sex with a girl down the road, right? And then they just might get her pregnant. And when a baby, and by the way, we now know what, you know, we know where babies come from. It's not the stork. We actually know it's sexual intercourse, right? When a baby then results from this so-called meaningless act of sex, that's going to be a shock in the life of that boy, because he's been drinking the Kool-Aid for 15 years that sex is meaningless, and now all of a sudden there's a baby in front of him. He's going to run back to the media, furiously angry, and he's going to go, "You guys lied to me. You told me that sex doesn't matter, and now there's a human being that's resulting from it." Well, that's a problem for the culture. That's a problem for Hollywood. So what does Hollywood support more than anything else? The one way to get rid of the evidence that sex has an objective meaning. Abortion. Kill the baby. Get rid of the evidence that sex actually means a life beyond you and your wife. That it actually means something unselfish. That it points to something beyond itself. As we religious people are trying to say that our entire lives point to something beyond itself. Get rid of the baby. The baby is the clear evidence that sex has an objective meaning. That's why we have abortion. Abortion is anti-Eucharist. It's literally the demonic inverse of the Mass. And what are kids running away from more than anything else in our culture? It's going to Mass on Sundays. Of course, it's genius. Abortion says, my body, this is my body. Listen to Gloria Allred and Gloria Steinem and all those feminists. It's my body. My body, my choice. There's only one other place I know where you could hear that proclamation. This is my body, which will be given up for you. Christ offers his body unselfishly to give us eternal life. The demonic inverse of that is to say, this is my body, therefore I can kill that other body. That's the opposite. For every one of the Catholic sacraments, there's a demonic opposite. And more that we're running away from Mass, the more and more we're raising up the right to have an abortion. Not only a right, it used to be rare and legal. Now they're saying it's a wonderful thing. More and more, what's that girl's name, Michelle, somebody from SNL, talked about how great, God bless America and God bless my abortion. We should be proud that I killed my child. So more and more that's being raised up as Mass is going down more and more. All we need in this is simply what I started with, saints. The antidote to any cultural ill is always the same. It's the saints. A saint is the opposite. It's an antidote to the culture. For every corruption that we had in any culture, the overly materialistic Middle Ages, what does God do? He gives us Francis of Assisi, who says, you know, you don't need to define yourself by your possessions. You don't need to define yourself by radical freedom. You can define yourself by obedience to Christ. The opposite. Every single culture, God will provide the heroes, the saints, that are the opposite of that culture. That's why in the end, this is such good news, that you guys would take the time on a Saturday when you could be sitting home watching basketball or maybe getting your food ready for tomorrow's Super Bowl party, and instead you're here with your son. You are the good news. There's a wonderful line by a guy named William Law. He wrote a book called Serious Call of the Devout Life. And I love this quote because it always like makes me feel guilty, and I'm Irish, I need to feel guilty every now and then. It says this, so I'm going to give this to you too. He said, if you will consult your own heart in utter honesty, you must come to the conclusion that there is one and only one reason why you are not as saintly as the early Christians. You do not wholly want to be. And I remember reading that going, oh, God, yeah, I guess the only reason why I'm not as saintly as I could be is that I don't really want to be. It's really hard to be a saint. So if we just rededicate ourselves to being the saints that we were intended to be, I swear they're going to get that faith eventually. At least it'll be offered with good seed to be caught or taught in the life of your child and the life of all your children. Your job is to help get you and your wife to heaven. And by virtue of that, each helping the other, and then by virtue of that, get your children, at least provide the opportunity for your children to choose Christ and go to heaven themselves. It's just, that's the only reason why you're put on this planet. Any other reason, I don't mean to offend you, but I don't really care. I don't know how much money any of you make, and I don't really care. I don't care how fancy your house is. I don't care if you got a fancy car. All that really matters ultimately is, are you living, trying to be a saint? And by virtue of being a saint, are you trying to get your kids an opportunity to go to heaven? You must all be doing that. Otherwise, I don't really know why you would be here. It's just so cool that you're here. That's the good news. And it's amazing. In every culture, it's defied the culture. And it keeps going. There's something amazing about the good news. Christ dies and rises. Death isn't the end. Death. Death, the thing that scares the living hell out of you, if you're honest enough to admit it, is that someday you're going to die. You don't have to be scared of it anymore. It's been defeated. Again, that isn't good news. That's fantastic news. Good news is I just saved 50% of my car insurance from Geico. That's good news. Great news is not that life's going to end well, but that life's going to end wonderfully. What Christ offers is the one thing that everybody wants, and that's joy, happiness. That's the one thing everybody wants for its own sake. Nobody says, I hope I'm happy so that I can make a lot of money. People say, I wish I had a lot of money so that I could be happy. Happiness is the one thing we all desire, and that's what Jesus offers. So that's gonna break the back of any culture if we allow it to. It's not that Christianity can't defeat the culture. It's that we're not trying. We've put it in a muzzle. We've put it down in a little box. We don't let it out. It's our job ultimately to let it out. And therefore, that's your weapon. Your weapon is joy. Your weapon is happiness. If you're not smiling, start. Start being happy with your family. Start being silly again. Be like a child. Have a massive party and spend lots of money on pizza and ridiculous things for them to eat and just celebrate life, because there's something about a happy person that's just a magnet for other people. For a couple of the people that went to St. Ignatius years back, I know a couple of you guys know this, we started a program there, a friend of mine started a program there about helping to bury people that needed pallbearers, the pallbearers ministry, done by a colleague of myself, by a guy by the name of Jim Skirl. We had more people in that ministry than all of the people that played football at Ignatius combined. Freshmen, JV, seniors. We had 200 kids involved in the pallbearers ministry. Why? Ask any of the kids that went to Ignatius and they will tell you in a heartbeat why. Jim Skirl. He was a happy, joyous guy. He lived out his faith in a really joyous way, and people like magnets were drawn to him. You want your kids to be drawn to you? Start smiling. Start telling dad jokes. Start being goofy. Start being silly. Start having fun. Start smiling. Start laughing. Make sure every time you say something and sometimes you have to discipline them, make sure you discipline them. And every time you say a disciplining word, make sure you say 7 positive things that affirm the heck out of them. Be joyful. It's our weapon. The culture doesn't have that. It's got pleasure. I'll give them that. It doesn't have joy. It doesn't have happiness. We do. That's our weapon. It's undefeatable if we just embrace it in our own lives. So I want to end this on a positive note, because it's more than positive. It's a hopeful note. We have an antidote to death. I told this story last year, so forgive me for being redundant. And I'll end with this because I'm probably running out of time. I had a kid at Ignatius years back, rock solid atheist, you know, didn't believe in God, and he wasn't going to really listen to me. And every now and then we would sort of, though, kind of spar, you know, a little bit back and forth. Because he was a really smart kid, and he kind of liked that, you know. He liked the intellectual interchange. And one day, as kids were still filtering into the classroom, he sat down and he kind of looked up to me and he said, "You know, Mr. Hogan, we're winning. We're winning. There's more atheists now in America than there ever was like 10 years ago." And I said, "You know, I think you're right. Actually, I think that's true. I think there's sort of an evangelical atheism out there that's trying to draw our kids in." I said, "But then again, you know, atheism looked pretty good in the Soviet Union a few years ago, too. Look what happened there. You know, things have a way of going up. Things have a way of going down." But I couldn't leave it at that. So I said to him, I said, "But there's one reason why I am always going to win and you people are always going to lose." Well, you know, he couldn't help but take the bait on that one. So he said, "Okay, Mr. Hogan, what?" And this is what we call in the business a teachable moment, right, Andrew? Teachable moment. And I looked him in the eyes and I said, "Because you offer no hope. Atheism offers no hope. If there is no God, then death is a wall. It's annihilation, blackness, nothingness, the cessation of all being. Everything you've ever hoped for, every great Brandenburg concerto and Shakespeare play, it's all going to end in annihilation. Life is a tragedy. And the definition, if you're an atheist, you have to believe that life is a tragedy. The definition of a tragedy is it ends bad. Well, if you're an atheist, you have to believe that life ends bad. If you believe in God, it isn't, and especially Christianity, it isn't that we believe that life ends well, it is that we believe life ends wonderfully. It ends with the triumph of death. It ends with you and all that you love in the kingdom of God together forever. That's the greatest power that will cut through like a laser beam any darkness that the culture has to offer if we would just put that in our arsenal. If that's our sword and it isn't sheathed, if we take it out and bear it, culture can't touch us. Culture can't touch us. Culture, they can try to ignore it. They ignored the fact that before Kobe Bryant got into that helicopter, he was at Mass. You didn't hear that, did you? But that's where he was, right? They forgot that little detail. He started his day in the morning worshiping God. That afternoon, he was with God. They didn't bring that up. But that's the truth, by the way. You know, the power of the gospel will cut through any of the illusions that the culture has to offer. It always has, and it always will. For 2,000 years, the faith of the church has weathered the burden of feudalism and selfishism, any ism, materialism, relativism. Hey, we even survived the 70s pet rock. We can survive anything along the way. That's ultimately the good news of Jesus Christ. That kind of joy, you have that kind of happiness in the way you just live your life, it will transform your marriage. It will transform your relationship with your kids. John the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd said, the only argument, good argument, against Christianity is joyless Christians. Christians who go to Mass on Easter Sunday and go, "Jesus Christ is risen today." Like, gee, did you tell your face about this joy? Because apparently it has no clue that you're living a happy life. Now, I think we've got to unleash the power of the gospel, which is the power of true happiness, true joy. Unleash that. There is no cultural force that can stand against us. We're going to win. The kingdom's going to win. We're on the winning team. We're on the winning team. It's not a question of we might lose battles. We're not going to lose the war. The war has already been defeated on the cross by Christ in his resurrection. That's the good news. So I wanted to leave you with that. Transform yourself into a happier person. Don't live like there's no tomorrow. That's what atheists do. Live like we know tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be the kingdom of God. So they don't have to fear death. All they have to do is make that joy more and more a part of their lives. Christ said, "I've come to give you life and have it more abundantly." So have it more abundantly. It's your right. Take the joy you're given, communicate that to your kids, and the gospel will stay with them. It'll cut through the fog of any cultural darkness along the way. That's not my good news. That's the good news. That's the good news of Jesus Christ. I probably kept you too long. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.